Online at bbc.co.uk/5live. This is Fee Glover on 5 Live.
So Sheikh Hamza Yusuf has been described in the press as the West's most influential Islamic scholar. A convert to Islam, he is the founder of the Zaytuna Institute in California, which seeks to educate people about the Muslim faith. He has also been described by one newspaper as President Bush's pet Muslim. You're very welcome on our programme this morning. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. Are you President Bush's link to the Muslim world? Have you been that?
No, not at all. I think after September 11th, I was the Muslim that was invited in to discuss the situation with him. So I think there was a lot of misunderstanding about that that came out of that. But in fact, I think it's quite the opposite.
You were responsible, though, for changing the name of Operation Infinite Justice.
Right. I did bring that up in that meeting, that Infinite Justice was, and I think Christians and Jews and any other monotheistic traditions would certainly consider Infinite Justice a blasphemous concept, the idea that somehow that America has infinite capacity for being just.
Yes, that kind of control freakery doesn't tend to go well in the secular or religious context.
Yeah, I think the response to that was the president said that we don't have theologians in the Pentagon, and I think that that would probably be kind of an interesting idea to maybe bring some theologians in to discuss things, because it seems like the moral case is very weak.
You've said some very interesting things about where Islam is at the moment, and the fact that you believe it's experiencing quite a dark age. Why?
Well, I would say that the Muslims, in a sense, are going through a particularly difficult time. I think that the Muslims were a very successful civilization and people for centuries, and in a way, it's difficult for us in the West to kind of imagine how the scenario was, because for many, many centuries, it was in fact the Muslims that were the enlightened people and the people of education, erudition, and right now in this post-colonial period that's been going on for some time. I mean, the decline of Islam was going on for a very long time, but the post-colonial period is particularly painful because not only were the institutions dismantled during the colonial period, educational institutions, so scholars, for instance, in the Muslim world, we really are suffering from a dearth of scholars in the Muslim world. And because of that, a lot of people that are not trained or educated theologically or in Islamic jurisprudence have suddenly become these spokesmen for the Islamic tradition, and very often they're extreme in their views, and these views are put forward somehow as being mainstream Islam, which it's like taking something like David Koresh from Waco, Texas, and saying that he represents mainstream Christianity.
Was that what had happened with the Taliban? Because I know that there were some scholars who believed that they were actually not forward-looking, and they had used an interpretation that was really quite backward.
Well, I think that the Taliban, I really feel that the Taliban, it was an attempt at just stabilizing an incredibly destabilized condition, and I think that, for instance, you know, this we often saw on the news media this one. It was the same picture over and over again of some Taliban hitting a woman, and we don't really know if it was a Taliban, but that's what the image showed. And I think that, you know, you can take a picture like Rodney King being beaten by the LA police, and suddenly all American policemen are going around beating people up. So, I think one of the things that the media does...
Yes, although the LAPD did admit they had a problem.
Well, they do have a problem, and but my point is that what the media tends to do is put a magnifying glass on things, and suddenly it would appear that that's the only thing going on. I think what was ironic was when the National Geographic found the famous picture of that Pathan woman who had been on the cover as a little girl, she actually said that she'd fared quite well under them. I think what people don't realize is that the entire country was in a state of anarchy. Indeed, they did shut down the schools. They told women to stay at homes. But part of the reason why they took over in the first place was because of the rape of Pathan woman by the northern Afghanis. So I just, I think, it was an unfortunate situation. But I also feel that there's been an incredible amount of disinformation personally, and I did speak to a lot of people that were there during that time. I think that the biggest mistake that that group made was allying with very radical elements that were in the country that were foreign, because the Afghani people, and I've lived spent quite a bit of time, many of my students have been Afghanis. The Afghani people are actually a very they're wonderful people, and I think many of the Western people that have gone to Afghanistan, and there's a famous French photographer, Roland, who spent a great deal of time there, has recently put out a book just saying that the Afghanistan he reads in the newspapers, it's not the Afghanistan he knew in the 1960s, which was a land of just incredible beauty, both in its human population as well as its physical geography.
Mm. Would you say, though, that you could make quite a fair comparison to politics in this country, whereby people say the rise of the right has been allowed because there is a slightly kind of moribund or stagnated platform in British politics? Is it the same in the Islamic world, that fundamentalism has been allowed to thrive?
No, I don't think there's any comparison at all, because I think what happens in the West, one of the things that happens when you do have a considerable amount of liberty and freedom to do what you want, a lot of people here just don't think about politics a great deal in the West, particularly in America. I mean, America, although it does have a lot of political activism, the political activism tends to be more like football teams, like I'm a Republican, you're a Democrat, and it's more Raiders and Buccaneers type approach to things. But in terms of serious political understanding, I think that the Muslim world has been living under despotism for so long that fundamentalism becomes a pathological reaction to the deep repressive elements that have been controlling the Muslim world. And so religion becomes a liberation theology. It becomes a voice for the voiceless. And I think really that's at the root of a lot of the problems. For instance, if you look at in the Palestinian situation, in the 1960s and 70s, it was Marxism, which was the dominant method of rebellion, or just as their political voice. And in the 80s and 90s, it begins to move into an Islamic discourse. But they bring in a lot of Marxist elements into the discourse. And so I think what's happened in the Muslim world is you've had a great deal of influence from Marxism, and so the Islamic political movements have often been tainted by a type of Marxist revolutionary rhetoric, because Islam is not, in fact, a revolutionary tradition. It attempts to purify existing societies rather than to completely turn them upside down.
But purify through converting.
Purify through converting, and through also through principles. I mean, I think the Islamic tradition is a tradition that it's not a theocratic tradition, in the sense that God is not speaking directly to us. The Muslims also believe in the idea of natural law, and they believe in revelation as principles that have been given through a messenger. And then the human mind attempts to apply those principles in the world. But human beings are always going to fall short of that. And I think one of the things that extremists do is they arrogate to themselves the voice of God. And that is why they're able to kill people innocently, because they really believe that they're acting with absolute authority. And this is, I mean, every religious tradition recognizes the total fallacy in that, in that perspective.
Let's hear from Colin, who's in King's Lynn, Mohammed, who's in Birmingham, and Farida, who's in Kingsbury. Hello, Colin. Very good morning to you. You're through to Sheikh Hamza Yusuf.
Good morning, Sheikh. Good morning, Fee. My question is really directed as a person of colour in the United Kingdom. I'm so afraid of what people in the Islamic community are doing, that there's no one actually in the UK from the moderate Islamic community who are speaking out against what I believe now is a cancer in your religion. Either someone has hijacked your religion to the point where it
but
is
why
now...
do you believe that, Colin? I mean, based on what? What's the manifestation of that cancer?
Well, you only have to look around you, around every corner of the globe at the moment. In the 1980s, you had the problem with communism and so on and so forth. Right now, the biggest problem that this world faces, where I have a 9-year-old, is my fear now is Islam and where it is going. And all I want is for people like yourself, who are reasonable, to actually address your community and actually find out why is it that your religion is inherently intolerant.
Right, okay.
Well, first of all, I would say that I think what you need to do, I mean, in religious studies, we have an idea of what's called descriptive and normative practice. Descriptive is what people do. Normative is what the actual religion teaches. And I think what you have to look at, you know, when historians look back at this century, the 20th century, and now we're moving into the 21st, I think that what's going to be really obvious is that the most violent people on the planet have clearly been Western Europeans and Americans, much more violent. I mean, the number of deaths that we have caused with our weapons of mass destruction reduces the rest of the world to really very small numbers. In the Muslim world, probably less than 2% of the violence in the last 100 years has actually had anything to do with the Muslim world. So I think it's very distorted because we don't really look in these historical perspectives. I mean, I feel that one of the things about the Muslim world is it has been suffering a great deal, and I think that what we're seeing, as opposed to a cancer, I would say that it's feverish. It's a immune system response that is out of balance, but because there is a great deal of suffering going on. I mean, if we look right now just at the globe, people are very unaware of what's happening in Chechnya, Kashmir, in Palestine, in Algeria, in places where there's just an immense amount of suffering, and certainly in Iraq. And I think a lot of Muslims feel that, and they're incredibly frustrated because they are a voiceless community that they really believe is not being listened to. And unfortunately, I mean, I personally really feel that one of the things that these extremist elements are is that they are a scream or a shout for an entire civilization and community to be heard. And this is one-fifth of the world's population. And if we don't start listening, I really feel that it is going to get worse, and that will be just tragic.
Colin, you surely don't equate all Muslims with the kind of actions that we saw by people claiming to be part of that faith on September the 11th. And they weren't actually, they weren't obeying the rules of the
Certainly
Quran.
Not
they
working
were
within the...
Living
see,
against
see,
the Quran.
See, I don't equate all Muslims. This is the point. I'm saying there is a problem. Too often they use this excuse or that excuse to excuse certain things. Look, as a Christian, the central tenet of my faith tells me to forgive my enemy. It doesn't tell me to go and murder my enemy.
But there are many people who have claimed Christianity to be their religion who have attacked and who have shown aggression, Colin. I mean, are you really fearful of the Muslim faith at the moment?
The point that the Sheikh made is valid, that over the generations, Christians have been far more responsible for far more deaths. I can accept that. But the point is, my daughter doesn't live in the 18th century. Or the 17th century.
I'm
she
talking really
now.
More about the 20th century.
She lives now. And I want her to be able to get on the flight when she's 18 and not worry about people who say that Allah tells them that they should crash a plane into a building.
But you can't hold that against every Muslim, Colin. Yeah,
but why don't we have more people actually come out and say this concept of suicide bombing or jihad is completely alien to this religion?
Colin, thank you very much for that call. It was something that Margaret Thatcher said after September the 11th, that she wanted to see more leadership from the Muslim community in this country
and
condemning it.
And we do have serious complications here. I mean, I think that overall, for instance, Palestine is incredibly complicated, and it does muddy the waters for clear thinking about things, because I think the vast majority of Muslims do view that the Palestinians have inherent rights there, and what they do, even if it's these extreme acts. I mean, I personally am completely against the use of violence against civilians, against women and children, and also what would be termed as something that is beyond government authority. If you're acting as a vigilante, not without, I mean, it's just anarchy. Mm-hmm. And Islam prohibits any type of vigilanteism.
We'll take more calls, 0500-909-693 after the travel, but also we have a statement which has just been received here. It says that the government has been forced to make a common statement on airport security. The common speaker has agreed to the request made by the Conservatives. At this stage, it hasn't been confirmed whether the Home Secretary David Blunkett will make this statement. There'll also be a statement on Iraq from the Foreign Secretary Jack Straw and the weekly business statement from the Commons leader Robin Cook. So probably the first will start at 12:30. And Jack Straw on probably at 1:15. You'll hear all of those things here on 5 Live. Hello, Anna.
Hello. Thanks, Fee. Perthink and Ross, first of all, at the A9, M90, A93 Broxton roundabout. Temporary roadworks are going on until 3:30 this afternoon. They reduced the roundabout to one lane only, so allow for delays on all approaches. In Stirling, the A875 stays closed for accident recovery between Balfron and the A811 junction at Cammock Hill. No change in Cheshire either. They're still clearing the lorry load from the A54 northbound at Bosley, north of Congleton. So in the meantime, that side of the road stays closed. In Derbyshire, though, the A38 has reopened northbound after an earlier car fire at the A52 junction at Markeaton. The A511 in Staffordshire, that's still closed after this morning's accident on Ashby Road in Burton-upon-Trent. And on public transport, there are still delays on London's tube network following this morning's major signal failure. Anna Rajan, 5 Live Travel.
Not all the weekend stories are sport related.
We'll be bringing you the full story and the background to today's shuttle disaster.
Well, we were awakened by a tremendous sound, and there was a bunch of debris that fell that was burning.
The last few minutes, NASA has announced that it started an inquiry.
It started in the left wing, but the rest of the space shuttle would stand no chance.
If you have any questions, please text us on 85058.
I think it's important to emphasize that the shuttle wasn't carrying any radioactive payload.
The Weekend News.
With Richard Evans.
And Asma Mir, Saturday and Sunday nights from 8, 5 Live.
Sheikh Hamza Yusuf is my guest this morning. So many calls, so if you can try and keep your questions brief, we would appreciate it. Mohammed in Birmingham. Very good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Fee. Good morning, Sheikh Hamza.
Good morning. Alaykum as-salam.
I just want to ask a question, please. It's due to the fact that you've been on record saying that Muslims should revive the intellectual tradition, especially the classical heritage of jurisprudence.
Right.
And many people have actually started doing that because of your advice. But what they find is that once they start studying the books and the scholars that are recommended traditionally, to try to get a traditional understanding, the teaching that they find is a teaching which is currently condemned as being extremist and fundamentalist. I myself tried to study Hanafi fiqh, and especially about jihad. And the very first line I ever read of a classical text of Islamic jurisprudence on jihad is that jihad is obligatory on the Muslims, regardless of whether non-Muslims attack us or do not attack us. And this is currently being taught in Islamic seminaries throughout the Muslim world by traditional scholars. And I find, for instance, that what you are saying currently, especially just what you have said recently, doesn't seem to gel with what you were saying previously. And I honestly find that there's some sort of disingenuity here, because if we are to discover our heritage has aspects which are not compatible with Western civilization. I just want to bring one point up. You brought up the Taliban.
Let's just hear the answer to that.
First of all, I would say that jihad is an obligation binding upon Muslims, which is defense of the homelands. It's also the removal of aggression. But the normative practice of the Muslims has always been that aggression is prohibited. The Quran is very clear on that. La ta'tadu, don't be aggressive in your wars. The Quran says if they incline towards peace, then you too should incline towards peace. The Quran permits, and certainly in traditional jurisprudence, treaties with non-Muslim nations, and those treaties are to be honored. You will find differing views, there is no doubt, because like I said earlier, Islam is not theocratic in we know exactly what God meant, but it's human attempts at understanding what God means. And that is why, first of all, most of those laws that deal with international relations, that deal with these, have nothing to do with your average Muslims. And when your average Muslims begin to take it upon themselves to implement laws that have to do with state polity and state power, this is where the confusion comes in. It's none of the average Muslim's business to be attempting to apply laws that are directed to the rulers of a country. And this is what's known in the Islamic tradition as fard ayn and fard kifaya. An ayn, everybody has to do, like praying five times a day, paying zakat, these things. Kifaya, only those people that need to do it, do it. The other people don't do it. And certainly in rules relating to government, that has nothing to do with the common people.
But I can see where the confusion would lie, though. I mean, if you're advocating that people do read these texts.
No, but if they read
them
without qualified teachers, absolutely, you're going to have serious problems. You can't just pick up a book and read. Look, in England, no one will allow a barrister who has not been trained in law school to go out and practice law. And constitutional law is certainly, you have to know interpretive practices, hermeneutics. You have to learn how to derive principles. I mean, if we had people reading a book on surgery and going out and performing surgery on people out in the society, it's madness. And so, you know, this idea that I can pick up my book and become a weekend mufti is absolute insanity.
The GMC is very busy dealing with some of those cases to do with medicine at the moment. Mohammed.
Can I just come back to one point, please?
Yes, of course you can, and then I want to ask you a question myself.
Okay, the point being, I'm not. What I'm trying to say, from, so you mentioned the Taliban themselves. The thing about the Taliban is that they were a government. They were Taliban, which means students. They didn't pick up books and just apply Islamic law. They were advised by Islamic scholars of a certain tradition in Pakistan, the Deobandi school. They themselves had scholars, and they interpreted their understanding of Islam and applied it on their nation. And that was condemned by the rest of the world. From their perspective, they were implementing Islamic law through qualified opinion, and their interpretation has been accepted by a lot of Muslims in the world. And it's an interpretation, and if they are condemned, you're forcing people who accept that interpretation into an extremist camp. And who decides ultimately?
Mohammed, do you feel that you are either tempted or you feel obliged to follow a jihad because of what you've read and because of what you believe you've been told?
No, what I want to do is I want to understand my Islamic heritage and learn from traditional scholars about Islam. Exactly what Sheikh Hamza wishes Muslims to do. Unfortunately, my scholars are the same scholars who learnt with the Taliban. And it cannot be said that the scholars, say, in Mauritania or in Egypt, who have a more liberal understanding, are better Islamic scholars than the scholars that the Taliban have studied under. But they are both follow a tradition. Now, I want to study Islam, and then I want Muslims to implement that in their lives. They shouldn't force it amongst other people, but then they shouldn't be condemned by people for implementing which is traditional Islam, and then said, oh, these are fundamentalists. I mean, we have certain penal laws in Islam, we have other laws, but we will always be condemned for applying our laws. This is a fact.
First of all, just in penal punishments, there's 6 penal punishments in the entire Islamic corpus. All the other ones are go under the category of a judge's discretion. In those 6, all of them should be avoided to the best of one's ability. But the point that it comes to the they said in 800 years the Ottomans didn't cut off any hands or stone any adulterers because people veiled people's faults. If somebody stole from you, if you forgive them, then they're not punished for it. But if you take it to the authorities, then the authorities are obliged to implement the law. A lot of Muslims don't understand these subtleties about Islamic law.
Mm-hmm. The problem is the Taliban were just simply condemned for even attempting to apply.
Well, I don't. You know, my personal feeling about the thought, I was not there. I didn't see it, and I really felt there was an immense amount of disinformation. It's well known in the West that the first victim or the first the first casualty of war is the truth. And I wasn't there. I didn't see it. So I really don't like to comment on something that I just... I mean, and that is a Islamic principle, that you should withhold judgment until you really understand something.
What is problematic for so many people, though, is the interpretation of something like Sharia law. And we were talking about it on the program
Absolutely.
Yesterday, the honor killings of women who've been raped.
Well, honor killings have nothing to do with Islam. Honor killings occur more in a one small segment of the Muslim world, and they occur amongst Christians and amongst Muslims.
Sure, but
and they used to occur
it's
ignorance. There's no, absolutely no basis for it. Absolute, complete ignorance. I'll give you an example. There was a time in America, there was a time in Mexico, where people killed their daughters for dishonoring the family. I mean, this is just a type of a primitive understanding about the world that exists in many, many places, and it has nothing to do with religion. And I think when we conflate religion and culture, when we conflate religion and human behavior, then we're in deep trouble. I mean, I think at the essence of the Islamic tradition, certainly the great world religions, at the essence of these traditions is the concept of mercy. I mean, the Quran begins in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. Killing my daughter because she's dishonored me is certainly, I think, has nothing to do with the concept of mercy.
Sure, but then why isn't more of a challenge made in those states? I mean, let's say in Jordan, by
honor killing is condemned. No, honor killing is condemned by all. I've never met anybody in the Muslim world, and I lived in the Arab world for over 10 years. I've never met anybody that has justified that. They've all seen it as something that's wretched. And I think even probably the people that have perpetrated the crime prior to it actually happening to them probably would have seen it as odious. But it becomes, I mean, this is the nature of culture. Cultures are very deep, and they have dark elements. I mean, we have dark elements here. In the United States, we've aborted over 20 million fetuses since Roe versus Wade. There's a lot of people that consider that to be an incredibly barbaric act of genocide, of mass murder. And I know that it's certainly a debatable point in the secular societies, but there are many, the Catholics view that as one of the great crimes against humanity. And yet, it seems to be an acceptable normative practice.
We will pick this up after the news, sport and the weather. It's 0500 909 693. Here is John Ketley.
And I keep looking in envy at the weather in Port Elizabeth, where it's gloriously sunny. A bit crofty wish you were there, aren't you? 28 degrees, nice.
He's the only member of the BBC Sports Department that's not. Yes, I'd like to join my colleagues, but there you go.
Somebody's got to, you know, fly the flag back home, haven't they? But anyway, I think it's going to be a very close finish, David, that game. I think there's plenty of life in that one yet. Now, we've got a line of discontinuity down the middle of the country. For example, it's 6 degrees in Cornwall with some sunshine. It's 6 degrees also in the Isle of Man without sunshine. It's just 2 in Bristol and 2 in Manchester. It's getting colder from the east. Now, with this colder weather, we are seeing at the line of discontinuity some drizzly rain and some sleet too for the Cotswolds. Still moving southwestwards across South Wales and South West England during the rest of today and for a time tonight as well. Now, as it keeps turning colder, it is turning brighter. It's turning much sunnier now in parts of Lincolnshire and East Anglia and Kent. And this sunnier weather will keep on moving into central parts this afternoon and other parts of the southeast as well. So it does set us up for a frosty night tonight. Temperatures is down to -4 or so, a hard frost to come in quite a number of parts of the country. Whereas further west and north, more drizzle to come in southern and eastern Scotland. Northern Ireland hanging out to some mist and fog as well, especially for the first part of the afternoon, but some weak sunshine amongst. Tonight, there could be a little bit of rain and drizzle coming into western parts of the province and the Outer Hebrides. Here, frost-free, but otherwise from frost for other parts of Scotland tonight.
Live news, live sport. This is 5 Live.
It's 11:33, 5 Live News with Alex Derbyshire.
Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz has denied suggestions that Baghdad has missiles which breach UN resolutions. The Chief Weapons Inspector, Hans Blix, is expected to tell the Security Council tomorrow that Iraq's developed a weapon with the potential to exceed the UN limit of 115 kilometres. The anti-terrorist operation around the UK's airports is continuing in response to threats of a terrorist attack. The Home Secretary, David Blunkett, will make a common statement on airport security this afternoon. The Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, will also make a statement on Iraq. Detectives investigating the murder of 19-year-old Marcia McDonnell, who died from three massive blows to the head, have confirmed that they're investigating a similar incident that took place in January. A 17-year-old girl suffered head injuries after a suspected attack in the Strawberry Hill area of southwest London. French media reports say a Spanish man charged with killing the British schoolgirl Caroline Dickinson 7 years ago has admitted the murder. 13-year-old Caroline was staying at a youth hostel on a school trip in Brittany when she was raped and killed by an intruder as she lay in bed. And three students from an agricultural college in Shropshire have been killed in a road crash. Three other men were badly injured in the accident, which happened near the entrance to Harper Adams University College near Newport last night.
Thank you. Here's David Croft with all the sport.
A flurry of runs, as John Ketley mentioned at the end of their innings, from New Zealand in their World Cup match against the West Indies in Port Elizabeth. Simon Mann has all the details.
They finished on 241 for 7 from their 50 overs. That was a good effort from New Zealand after being 147 for 6 in the 33rd. They got there thanks to a sensible innings from wicketkeeper Brendan McCullum, who was 36 not out, and some belligerence from Andre Adams, who finished 35 not out, and he got those runs from 24 balls with two sixes and a four. New Zealand struggled early on. Stephen Fleming 25, Vittori 13, Styris 5, they were 66 for 3. Then a good stand between Astle and Cairns, but then both went in quick succession. Astle was caught behind, although I don't think he hit it off Hines, and Cairns went to long off, also off Hines, who finished with 3 for 35. So West Indies need 242 to win.
Very interesting. See how it works out. England's cricketers should have been in Harare today playing their opening World Cup match against Zimbabwe. Instead, they're in Cape Town. They've had a three-hour session with sports psychologist Steve Bull in an attempt to refocus their attention on the cricket rather than the politics. They'll be in the nets this afternoon. Meanwhile, England's administrators have until 4 o'clock today to submit their appeal for a change of venue for the Zimbabwe fixture. The ICC Technical Committee will meet tomorrow to discuss the report. South Africa's Jonty Rhodes is out of the World Cup for at least 3 weeks. He's had an operation to insert pins into his hand after he broke it playing against Kenya. New Fox PLC are now in control of First Division Leicester City Football Club. The name of the club could revert to Leicester Foss, according to reports. That's the original title of Leicester, if the fans decide that's what they want. Chairman-elect John Holmes. Nottingham Forest will officially complete the loan signing of Manchester City striker Darren Huckabee on February the 24th. He'll be available for the remainder of the season, including the playoffs, should Forest secure a top six finish. In golf, Ernie Els is leading the field after the first round of the Johnny Walker Classic in Perth. He's on 8 under par, one shot clear of England's David Lynn. Nick Faldo and Justin Rose are both on 4 under. And Brian McGee will now defend his IBO super middleweight boxing title against Miguel Jimenez in Huddersfield on Saturday week. McGee's original challenger, Julio Cesar Vasquez, pulled out due to injury.
Call Fee Glover 0500 909 693 or text 85058.
Sheikh Hamza Yusuf is my guest this morning. We will return to our conversation after a brief chat with Angus Crawford, who can tell us about the second round of figures released from the latest UK census. Hello, Angus.
Hello, good morning.
What do we now know?
Well, the population is increasing. We're getting older. We see ourselves as being more ethnically diverse. We're becoming much more lonely. And we're either a bunch of hypochondriacs or we're a lot more ill than we used to think we were.
Great. Good news all round, then.
Yes.
Why do you say that we believe ourselves to be more ethnically diverse? Surely we either are or we aren't.
Well, it's important, this, because in 1991, the figures showed that those people who considered themselves from an ethnic minority background made up about 6% of the population. Now, figures today show that figure to be 9%, but you can't really make a direct comparison, because for the first time in 2001, they were able to ask people, do you consider yourself of mixed race? So clearly, the 6 to 9% cannot be seen as there being this 3% growth in an ethnic minority population. It's simply that people see themselves in a different way. Now, there will have been a growth of some sort, which is difficult to quantify, although something like 1.2% of people said they were of mixed race, whereas potentially back in 1991, they either didn't fill in the box or they said they were white.
Angus, thank you very much indeed. More on that in the midday news with Alan Robb. Farida is called from Kingsbury. Farida, very good morning.
Good morning, Jufi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Hamza.
Alaikum salam.
I heard about your work about 12 years ago from somebody who'd come from the States, and I've been praying fervently since then that we have more people like you. Now, Sheikh Hamza, my question to you is, ever since the speech on the axis of evil, feeling more and more like a crusade vis-a-vis Christianity versus Islam. Do you perceive this modern conflict in the Middle East as a clash of civilizations, or is it a clash of religious beliefs?
I would call it a crash of civilizations. I think it's actually the absence of civilization that leads to these type of conflicts. In terms of a crusade, I think there's no doubt that there are certain elements in the U.S. that have a crusader mentality, and we see this in the fundamentalist Christian branch, and there are people within the administration that definitely cater to that element. I think that America, by and large, is as a country, and certainly the government, is not opposed to a secularized Islam. That is, an Islam that does really not impinge on the society at large. But I think when we talk about an Islam, for instance, that prohibits usury, interest, a lot of the modern banking schemes, an Islam that also permits people to defend their homelands and things like this against aggression. I think that there is definitely a feeling in the government that they do not want to see this type of Islam because it's antithetical to their interests in the region. And I think at root, for most of these people, I don't think they're ideologically committed to the Christian religion to put it in those terms. I think it's much more simply about power politics and a kind of Machiavellian attempt at having their hegemonic concerns in the region fulfilled.
Blair and Bush have both said they'd share a very similar platform of Christianity. You've spent a bit of time, at least, with President Bush. Do you believe that Christianity lies somewhere within his kind of remit and purpose?
I think definitely he's got a Christian, some type of adherence to the Christian religion, no doubt. It helped him through his alcoholism. But again, I think that the people around Bush, by and large, I think are power politicians, and I think that religion probably plays less of a role in their minds than political concerns.
Do you believe President
Bush... I could
Bush...
be very wrong about that, but that's my gut feeling.
Okay. Do you believe that President Bush is at all credible to a Muslim audience?
No. I think that, by and large, that America has lost all credibility in the Muslim world. I think that many, many Muslims actually look towards America, certainly during the 50s and 60s, as being a force that might help them get out of the yoke of despotic regimes. But America ended up not only supporting but actively supporting many of these regimes. Certainly Saddam Hussein is a creation by and large of the United States. And I think that's where unfortunately, the hypocrisy is much more evident to most of the Muslims. And I think it's tragic in a sense because I think the ideals that America was founded upon are powerful ideals and they're rooted also in the Islamic tradition as well, the ideals of self-determination and the right for people to pursue happiness. And
which are the bits, though, that really don't fit?
Where?
Between American culture and society now and Islamic culture.
Yeah, I think that probably some of the most distasteful aspects of Western culture generally are not just distasteful to Muslims. I think many just good people in the West find the pornographic element, the immorality that is kind of permeated our culture. I mean, I've got children. I don't like my children to look at billboards and see. And it's not that I think that bodies are disgusting, and I don't. But I think that there's a time and a place for everything. And I certainly don't feel that that type of sexuality should be publicly displayed. Those aspects. And I think that by and large Muslims share those with a lot of people in the West.
Does Tony Blair have a credibility to a Muslim audience?
I think that that Blair, I mean, Michael Moore said that, you know, when you see Tony Blair and George Bush standing side by side, he said, you see one intelligent man and you wonder what he's doing with the other one. I mean, that might be a little unfair, but I do think that it's very sad that Labour has completely capitulated. And I did remark that it troubles me that the great Lion of Great Britain has become a feather in the tail of the American Eagle. I mean, I think that Great Britain should play an extraordinary role of being a moral voice in the West, and I think that Great Britain can be that voice that reminds America that not only is the path that it's pursuing a dangerous one, but it's the one that Great Britain herself has been down, and that's the path of empire, and ultimately it leads to failure. And I think that the British people are acutely aware of that because they saw it in their own history.
Ian joins us from Glasgow. Good morning, Ian.
Hello. Yes, good morning. I'd like to know how you define empire, because at the height of the Ottoman Empire in the 20th century, I don't know if your listeners are aware of this or not, the worst atrocities committed in the history of mankind prior to the First and Second World Wars was committed by the Turkish Muslims
against the Armenian
Christians. Oh, 1 million to 1.5 million Christians killed because they were not of the faith of the Muslims.
That's absolutely...
Could I just also please, may I speak? Because
sure.
We do have freedom of speech in this country. In certain Islamic countries, I would not be able to express myself as I am just now, and neither would you if I was in certain Islamic countries.
Right.
Could I just also say to you that it seems extraordinary that we have a situation just now where everything seems to go down to the satanic West, where in fact, if you consider the history of the Islamic faith, you do seem to be based your tenets on hate and not on moderation. You have a problem, I think, with the moderate Muslims should be challenging the authority of the extremists, the mullahs and the imams. If you don't have that situation, then I'm afraid that the rest of the world, the rest of the major religions of the world, are going to perceive the Islamic faith as based on fear and injustice.
Which particular states and regimes, Ian, are you talking about?
Well, in Egypt, for example, you do have what you would call a moderate Muslim country, where I believe 20% of the population in Egypt is not of the Muslim faith. But you have Islamic extremists in that country where if they were to take over the mainstream people in Egypt just now, they would reduce the non-Muslims to zero. In Saudi Arabia, for example, you only have one religion permitted there, which is based on a hideous regime where all sorts of atrocious sentences are passed on individuals because they dare challenge the authority of that state.
Right. Okay. Well, let's just try to tackle that. Sheikh Hamza, would you admit that there does need to be more forward thinking, a wider appreciation of freedoms that the West have embraced in some parts of the Muslim world?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't. But I must address the idea that the Ottomans, that this is the worst atrocity ever in the history of, I mean, that's blatantly false. It's well known the Armenian tragedy that did happen happened. By most historians, there was a recognized exaggeration of numbers because of anti-Russian propaganda at the time. But anti-Turkish propaganda at the time, based on Britain's interests there. But the point about the Ottomans at that point, it was already a secularized government. In fact, the Armenians were well known to be one of the few communities in that region that had reached very, very high levels within the Ottoman government itself, ministerial levels and things like that. And I think the Ottomans actually, by and large, with their atrocities, because like any empires, they did have their atrocities, but by and large, they were known to be one of the most tolerant civilizations in the pre-modern world, certainly.
Right. In the modern world?
In the modern world, we've got a real serious problem in the Muslim world, there's no doubt. And I think that the suffering that goes on, again, is, I mean, I lived in the Muslim world, and I certainly, many of the things that I saw, I think the abuse of women in many of the countries that has to do with just ignorance. I really feel that. And it wasn't that long. I mean, we forget that women didn't inherit in this country in the 19th century. I mean, we kind of pride ourselves on these leaps and bounds that we've made in the last few decades. But the reality of it is, I mean, if we look at our own history, I mean, it took quite a considerable amount of time to achieve certain things that we've achieved in the West. And I think that in the Muslim...
Yeah, but the difference surely is that, I mean, the suffragette movement in this country was one where women were prepared to lose their own lives in the name of freedom, whereas right. if you're a woman living in Jordan or Saudi Arabia at the moment, you are more likely to lose your life at the hands of the state if you try and pursue ultimate freedom than at your own hands. And that surely is wrong. And you can, you know, you can say...
I'm not going to justify...
You've made leaps and bounds, yeah, but I'm, you have to look forward, not back.
Exactly. And I'm not going to... What I'm saying is that change does take time. I mean, we forget the revolutions that we've had. We forget all the blood that's been spilt in Western civilization that we can speak freely. You know, many of us would have been plebeians in another age. We wouldn't even have the right to be discussing government policy. That was the right of the lords and the aristocracy. Well, people fought and died in order for us to have these. And people just kind of forget that. They think that it's always been like this. It hasn't always been like this. And mm-hmm. I think it's going to take a lot of time for other parts of the world to achieve certain levels of liberty and freedom. And I would like to see it done without the type of bloodshed that has occurred. And I think that it's very easy for us to point our fingers at other societies and civilizations. I'm not defending the Muslim world per se. I grew up in California. I was raised by a woman who was very active. My mother was very active in the civil rights. I grew up in a liberal progressive tradition. I'm not going to defend despotism. I'm not going to defend the atrocious human rights records in many parts, not just of the Muslim world, but around the world. But I'm certainly also very aware of how easy it is to attack that world without really understanding it at a much deeper level. I mean, if you take a book by the brilliant British historian David Frumkin, A Peace to End All Peace, I mean, he shows you that it was, in fact, Britain and France that set up a type of scenario in the Middle East that would ensure that the countries in that area yeah. would remain in this type of morass.
So isn't the real danger in taking all those lessons from history that the place that we find ourselves in at the moment, which is slightly kind of fists up between two massive cultures, will actually lead to both suffering? There will not be the time for progression.
Thank you. I mean, that is exactly how I feel, and I think that if we don't listen to each other, and it's going to be very difficult, but it's going to take some real intelligence and reason, and I think that's what human beings unfortunately are not very adept at when they're just constantly in the turmoil and agitation of crises mm-hmm. management.
It's been wonderful having you here. Thank you very much indeed for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, thank you for all the calls. And I know that we didn't manage to put very many on air, but we do appreciate the fact that you're listening and wanting to get involved. Here's Anna with the travel.
In Stirling, the A875 remains closed whilst an accident's recovered between Balfron and the A811 junction at Cammock Hill. The